Energy and Environment Committee. This is Wednesday, April 11th, and just to let you know, for folks who are waiting, we're going to proceed with the work sessions first, which should go pretty quickly, except for House Bill 2785. That'll be at the end. We're waiting for those amendments, and that will probably be about 2:30 or 2:45. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the work session on House Bill 2723, since we have the primary author of the bill, Representative Greenlick. And Kat, if you can let us know what the amendments, the dash, which ones are we on today?
You're good. I can't describe them.
Okay. So why don't you give a summary of the bill, and then we can talk about the dash 3 and the dash 4 amendments.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2723 clarifies existing authority of cities and counties to approve creation of a parcel of land that does not meet land division requirements. It specifies that the lot must be purchased without knowledge of the improper subdivision from an unrelated seller with whom the buyer has no ongoing business relationship. There's a dash 3 and a dash 4 amendment before you, and Ron Eber from DLCD is going to describe them.
Okay. Mr. Eber, are you here somewhere hiding? There you go. Thank you, Ron. I appreciate you being here today.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
Before, if
Representative Greenlick.
Then I'll leave. And Ron,
you want to stay for the vote?
Thank you. And thank you for letting me sit here while, you know, it's still easier than those chairs for me. I'm Mitch Greenlick, State Representative from House District 33, and I just wanted to make one very brief comment before Ron differentiates the threes and the fours. He went through the threes in the last session, and it's a very simple difference. But I do want to comment again. There was a work group cast of thousands that worked on this. Ron guided through the process, but there were really many groups. The dash 3 amendments represented complete consensus of all the group, of all the different members in the group, except one party, the realtors. Many of the realtors' issues had been taken care of in the draft threes, but there was one residual issue that Rod can explain. It's on page 12 of the draft 3 amendments, page 12, right at the top, item C, line 2, was an issue that was that continued to bother the realtors, and the dash 4 amendments simply delete that section. That's the difference between the dash 3s and the dash 4s. I think, from my perspective, I'm happy to live with either the 3s and the 4s. There's much to be said with leaving that item on page 12 in. There's much to be said with taking it out, and I trust Ron will give you the argument on both sides, and then I would be delighted if the committee picks one of the threes or the fours. If it doesn't come out the way one of the parties wants, they can fight it again in the Senate. But I think these amendments are an extraordinary job, and I really wanted to recognize the work of all the group, including the realtors and the department and Thousand Friends and the counties. And you'll hear from some of them as to which they prefer. I think most, except the realtors, prefer the dash threes. So I really thank you for hearing this, and I hope for moving it today. And again, they've done a great job at producing something that will be very useful in solving a set of problems that the counties particularly have been wanting to solve for a long, long time.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick, for your hard work in this bill and for bringing this to our committee.
It's Tom Powers and the team.
Mr. Eber?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber, Farm Forest Land Specialist with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. As Representative Greenlick points out, we have the dash 3 and dash 4s before you. The dash 3s are essentially the same as the dash 2s. There were a couple of minor, and I would emphasize minor, word smithing issues that were changed between the 2s and the 3s. On page 2, line 17, we extended from 60 days to 90 days the amount of time that one of these newly validated units of land would have to have a partition plat filed. And in subsection 6 and 7, we clarified to get the language consistent with the rest of the bill in terms of referring to validation of units of land and referring to the correct statutes that starts the timeline for the standards that are applicable in cities and counties to land use applications. And those are really the only changes, and as Representative Greenlee points out, the only difference between the 3s and the 4s is that the dash 4s take out the amendment to the seller's disclosure statement. That from the other party's standpoint, except for the realtors, felt that it was another tool and another way to focus people as early as we can in the process on this very important issue, that you need to be assured that the unit of land that you're buying is actually a lawful lot or parcel. And the seller may not know it, the buyer may not know it, but this is a chance to highlight that issue. It's one of the things they would have to find out, and this would hopefully lead them to clarify that issue, and we won't have any more of these, or certainly far less, in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Reaper. Any questions for the department? Okay. Thank you very much. We are in work session, so I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2723.
Okay, Representative Cannon moves the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2723. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any objections?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Jensen, so noted for the record. Those are the opinion that the, so those amendments have been adopted and the motion carries, and then I will take a motion on the bill.
Madam Chair, I move the House Bill 2723 as amended by the dash 3s to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2723 as amended with the dash 3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
In light of the fact that I'm without any colleagues here today, how do I get a second vote for a minority report?
They are not in the building today. I had no idea that Representative Smith was not going to be here today until I got slipped a little note.
I'm just wondering if you orchestrated this.
I can never guess with Representative Smith what his schedule is going to be.
No, I'm fine. Go ahead.
Okay, I will have the... Oh, I'm sorry.
Chair, I just wanted to make a statement that, I think this is a great bill, and that I can understand concerns about this amendment. I'm going to support it because I think there are good points and bad points about the amendment. And I am concerned that people, when it comes time to fill out this form, might not know how to fill it out. And I don't want legal issues down the road for these people because they don't know whether this is a legal lot or not. But I do think that, all in all, this is a good bill, and I'll support it.
Well, I appreciate both your comments and concerns. We had a very robust discussion about it, and I think that there are some concerns about, I think, on any of these that people check off, whether or not they're legally responsible. And so I think I mentioned I had the same concern about item number, H, now I, are there any zoning violations for nonconforming uses? Because chances are, unless somebody is, really tracked the history, they're not going to know whether it's a nonconforming use as well. So I think that there are many items on this that could be questionable, and this isn't necessarily inconsistent with what's an existing disclosure statement. So I appreciate your concerns. Any other?
Madam Chair, and the thing that makes me comfortable with this solution is that the format of the disclosure statement has an unknown column, so that it's not as though the seller has to commit to knowledge one way or the other on this issue, but by having to mark either yes, no, or unknown, then there is some tickler or suggestion to the buyer, if it's marked unknown, that that's something they need to look into themselves, that they can't rely on some representation made to them by the seller.
Thank you for that comment.
Madam Chair, my only comment would be about the process. I think we got this idea came to us. It's come to previous legislatures. We had parties get together in I think, goodwill and spirit of cooperation to wrestle with this really complicated issue in law that previous legislatures have been unable to resolve, and I think we have a bill that works really well. So it's a real testament to the folks, including the stakeholders who got together on this.
Thank you for those excellent comments, and I appreciate all the hard work that's been done on this, and I think it's not perfect, but it's pretty close for given the tough issue that I think we're addressing here. So I will take a motion.
I think I made...
Oh, I'm sorry. We are in the middle of a motion. And so Representative Cannon has moved House Bill 2723 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended with the dash threes. We've had discussion, and now the clerk will call the roll. Thank you.
Representative Smith?
Aye. Excused.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Excused.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Dinkfelder?
Aye. The motion carries, and House Bill 2723, as adopted with the dash three amendments, has received the recommendation of this committee, and I'm going to ask or assign Representative Greenlick to carry the bill. So this was his bill. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2723 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 105. And can you give us a brief description of the bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 105A increases Department of Environmental Quality fees assessed on cargo, passenger and dredging vessels, and onshore and offshore facilities to support programs related to oil spills. There's an amendment in front of you, SB 105-A2, and that clarifies that the bill applies to liquefied natural gas, but only when it's in transit through state waters or at a facility that receives liquefied natural gas from a vessel.
Okay, thank you, Kat. I'm going to ask the DEQ to come up. And actually, I'd like to ask Gary Bauer from Northwest Natural, since this was an amendment that he had worked on, and you could briefly tell me if you're happy with the amendment, you guys are both okay, give it the blessing.
Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, Alan Kippett from DEQ, Land Quality Administrator. Yes, Gary and I have worked on this. The language in the amendment is really designed to clarify that these are LNG vessels delivering liquefied natural gas are the facilities that we're and the vessels we're concerned about here. We do approve the amendment.
Okay.
Chair Dinkfelder, thank you. And I'll just set everything.
Okay, great. All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel on this amendment? All right, thank you, gentlemen. And with that, I'll take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 105.
Representative Cannon moves the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 105. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the dash A2 are adopted, Senate Bill 105.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 105A as amended by those dash 2s to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, Representative Cannon moves the dash 2s, or Senate Bill 105A as amended with the dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, so this will go, just to clarify, this will go back to the Senate for concurrence, is that...
Correct.
Assuming passage on the
Assuming
floor.
Assuming
passage
on the
floor. Then it goes back to the right. Senate for concurrence since we've amended the Senate bill.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Those of the opinion that Senate Bill 105A should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation vote aye. Those
Did
vote
we
no.
vote on the amendment?
As amended with a dash, yeah, two. Yeah, we voted on it. There are no objections.
Okay.
Okay. Clerk will call the roll. I'm not doing roll call.
Representative Smith, excused. Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley, excused. Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Dinkfelder?
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is declared passed, and I'll take a motion for consent calendar.
Madam Chair, I move that we...
Madam Chair, I would object.
Okay, would you like to carry the bill? No, I will ask Representative Cannon then to carry the bill. Objection noted to being on the consent calendar, so with that, I will assign Representative Cannon as carrier to the House floor.
Very good. Okay.
All right, with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 105 and open up a work session on House Bill 2010. And, colleagues, this is the purpose is to move House Bill 2010 to the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee without recommendation. Any discussion?
I'll make a motion.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2010 be referred to the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee.
Representative Cannon has moved that House Bill 2010 be referred to the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay. So the motion, having received required majority, is declared passed. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2010. And I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3488. And this is relating to energy tax credits, the business energy tax credits. I think Kat is going to talk about the bill, and then we're going to have Representative Bruhn come in. Are you going to go?
To go here.
Yeah. Could you go?
I'll go again.
Well, actually, you can give a review of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, House Bill 3488 expands business energy tax credits to include credit for renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities.
Okay, well, while we're waiting for Representative Bruhn, I'll have Jeff Bissonnette and John Miller come up, please. I figured as much.
Okay.
I wasn't trying to sneak one over on you.
No.
What happened to Jeff?
He must have.
Oh, there he is. You heard his name. Jeff, can I come on? I'm just going to try to move things along since we have several hearings today.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bissonnette, here today representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, which is a statewide collaboration of public interest organizations involving consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, clean energy businesses, faith groups, and labor. One of our members is the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, and with me at the dais is John Miller, the executive director of the association. And in the audience are about 40 members of the association here to talk to you about 3488. You had some discussion about the issues in the bill when House Bills 2211 and 2212 were before this committee back a couple months ago. But in discussions with the primary sponsors of those bills, they wanted those to move separately and us to follow a track a little bit behind them. So we're here before you again to talk about some of the issues regarding solar and the business energy and residential energy tax credits. And with that, I'll introduce John Miller with OSEA.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Miller, and I am the director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. We're a group of small business contractors, energy professionals, distributors, and manufacturers such as Solar World and Kyocera. We're here talking in support of House Bill 3488 and the amendments to the BETSI and RETSI credits. As some of you might know, the solar industry is one of the fastest growing industries in the world, and in the past 2 years alone, they have invested or committed investments of over $1 billion to the Northwest economy, $600 million up in Washington and $400 million here in Oregon. The Oregon tax credits have played a large role in that success for the state. So we know that these credits are critical to the growth of the solar industry in Oregon, and they not only help to attract businesses like Solar World and other manufacturers, but they also help small businesses that are located all throughout the state of Oregon. We have many of them sitting in the room today that have come from around the state of Oregon to see the process in action here. So the amendments in House Bill 3488 are an effort to make the Betsy and the RETC credits, the Betsy in particular, more viable, and to keep the workhorse of the solar industry, solar hot water, in the front of our clean energy efforts. It also addresses the continuing growth in residential solar electric system size by allowing systems or changing it from 2 kilowatts to 5 kilowatts. So in with regard to the Betsy, in keeping a familiar front-ended format that it currently has, will enable viable projects to go forward that otherwise would not. Retaining that same front-loaded structure that the current Betsy has will attract more businesses to Oregon and make our industry stronger here. We also need to address the oversight of leaving solar hot water out of the picture. Solar hot water is the workhorse in the industry. Today in Oregon, we have around 25 megawatts of solar installed. 22 megawatts of that 25 is from solar hot water. So we just can't leave it behind and forget it. So that the change to increase the credits to 3,000 for the solar hot water systems is very important to us to continue growing those systems in the state of Oregon. The solar industry is growing very rapidly, and we want those jobs and economic opportunities here. The strong growth that we're seeing now at 30% annually is predicted to continue for the next 30 to 40 years. That means a lot of jobs and a lot of economic opportunity for the solar industry. So we hope that you support the efforts from the tax credits and great job that they're doing to grow the solar industry in Oregon, and we know that House Bill 3488 helped to do that. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And Representative Bruin, thanks for coming out of revenue. We started faster than we thought, appreciate you coming out.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Scott Bruin, State Representative for House District 37, which is Westland to Alton. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for hearing House Bill 3488 today. I'm a little late to intro it since it's already been intro. You've heard the basic tenets of the bill. I won't talk any of the detail because there's folks at this table and folks behind me that can talk circles around me on the details of solar energy, and I know this committee he's already heard quite a bit of testimony related to other bills, Repsy and Betsy, to name two, regarding the merits of solar energy. This bill, the genesis of this bill, started back late last summer, and there's a lot of folks that have been working very hard on solar energy for a long time. My introduction to being a big proponent of solar energy actually simply was reading about what they did in California last year and a long-term effort they had undergone in California that was ultimately picked up and supported by their governor to expand their credits and to expand their method of net metering, all with the simple idea of what we're trying to accomplish in 3488, which is to do what we can to speed the implementation, to speed the dispersal, if you will, of both residential and business solar energy use, as well as to sort of create a better environment, if you will, for investment into those technologies. So not only using the technology itself, not only encouraging expanded use of the technology, but also creating a business environment which would encourage those that are already in the industry here and those that are interested in expanding the industry here, make Oregon a little bit of a solar energy. I guess the grandiose vision would be to make Oregon for solar energy what it already is for tennis shoes, and that's sort of the idea here with renewable energy. The reasons to do this have been well articulated. I'll just narrow it down. We're talking a lot about renewable energy this session, and that's a great and wonderful thing to be talking about. I'm particularly enamored, if you will, with solar energy for a few reasons, even above and beyond some of the other renewables we're talking about. First of all, I think the best thing about solar energy is it is at its primacy. It's at its prime when it's needed the most, and I think that's unique among energy. During the hottest days is when we're both in businesses and commercial applications and residential applications is when we're using the most energy, and that's when solar energy is producing the most energy. It's also, we have a great state. We have a lot of sunlight. It's interesting, even our cloudiest, and I just learned this yesterday, it's a great statistic. Even our cloudiest area of the state, Astoria, is still from an efficiency standpoint, as far as the, and I won't try to explain the science behind it, but as far as capturing solar energy, even Astoria is ahead of Germany, and Germany is the world leader in solar technology and solar usage. So solar energy is a wonderful thing. It's certainly a technology of today, and it's absolutely a technology of tomorrow, and so I applaud you for looking at this bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate you being a co-sponsor on that, and I've heard that statistic before about us having more sun than Germany, but yeah. During February, it still doesn't make me feel better. I can tell you that much. So are there any questions for this panel before we let Representative Bruin go back to revenue? And
thank you. And there's a if I may, there's a representative here from Bruce Hanna's office who's not. Okay.
And I'm going to call him. Okay, I'm going to call him up right afterwards. But I thought there might be some questions for this panel. Yeah.
If you would, please.
Representative Jensen.
Some questions.
Sure.
One of the things I'm a little concerned with, and I'm usually not one that gets on this particular diatribe, but with the market and the market driving, things. If I understand correctly, we're offering tax credit. We're proposing offering tax credit here for the manufacturing of facilities, solar energy facilities. That is something that I would put on my roof or whatever. I'm sorry, I'm not as versed in solar energy as perhaps all of the rest of you are. But I also understand that that as a business or a homeowner, that I can get tax credits for building or establishing or installing solar energy into my home. So we're double tax crediting this particular industry right here. Is that am I missing something, or is that correct?
What it does is it allows, and once again, in fact, do either of you want to? I can tackle that, but if you guys are the technical experts, let the elected guy stumble, and then we'll take care of it. That's
they'll bail you out if you need it.
In a way, it does. In one specific example, if you are a manufacturer of a technology that is solar energy related, your Bob's solar energy panels, and you make them, in Pendleton, in your hometown, and Bob's solar energy panels company also employs also in their physical plant uses solar panels, solar energy. Yeah, they'd be receiving double tax credits. That would be, unless I'm mistaken, that would be the only example of where an entity, either a corporation or an individual, is getting a double tax credit.
Now, supposing, Representative, that I'm just Bob Citizen over in the uncharted wilderness in eastern Oregon, I'd buy. For simplicity purposes here, excuse me, but I buy a panel that, the members here, or one manufacturer here, gets a tax credit for, this particular bill.
Right.
And then I put that panel on the roof of my house, and I get some sort of tax credit for it.
Correct.
So we're double dipping the tax credits here for solar energy.
We are, with the understanding, the reason we're doing this. I mean, there's no secret to why we're trying to jumpstart this industry. We're trying to do two things. We're trying to jumpstart the industry from an industry perspective, not a use perspective. That's also what we're doing. But that's a second. We're doing two things. We're jumpstarting the industry, trying to give the industry itself a better, stronger, more pervasive foothold in Oregon, and encouraging individuals to. We've noticed that despite the growth of use both in residential and in commercial terms of solar energy, it's not as fast as some would like. As we think there's benefit to be had, the
adoption of the technology hasn't been as fast as we would have liked. We've looked at that, and once again, this work group started back in the summer. It started with just a phone call to Sybil Ackerman, the OLCV. It led to Jeff and to Jeremiah Bauman and to John Miller and a group of others to sort of start hashing through these ideas. I'll distill it down. It's not rocket science. We looked at the available tax credits. We looked at the cost of the systems. Okay, the cost of the systems are coming down as technology improves to manufacture these, as more people use these. Of course, just as in any business endeavor, you're getting reduced costs. But the costs weren't coming down fast enough to really what we see push enough people, push a critical mass over the edge, if you will, to make the decision or not make the decision regarding solar energy. So this is not trying to hide anything. This is just to increase the encouragement to utilize solar energy. It's that simple.
Follow up. And thank you very much, Representative. I appreciate your comments on this and your explanation of this. That's kind of what I'm trying to understand here. I mean, first I hear that the Washington, Oregon are two of the leading states with this, and then I hear we've got to have a double dip tax credit in order to jumpstart the industry, and so I'm a little I'm not real fond of tax credits
we are leaders. We're just not where we want to be.
And I can appreciate and I can go with that and I can understand that. I just needed to get that type of clarification of where we are, what we're doing, and where we want to go with this. With that as a a question, then do we have a sunset on this? I don't see it. And what are we proposing?
Representative Purcell, you will hear from many of the other people who are going to testify about where we are compared to other states and what's currently available. Yep. Regarding sunset, my understanding is any bill going to revenue now is going to get a sunset. Yes. There is a sunset being added to all tax credits.
Is it immoral or illegal for us to edit before it goes to revenue?
Yes. Oh. That's up to the purview of the revenue committee.
Okay.
And since the chair is happened to the Betsy already. Did you want to try to respond? And then we're going to bring up the next panel.
Representative Broom is very self-effacing, but he got it right. I just wanted to make a further clarification on a couple of things. One is we are talking about two different tax credits. A manufacturer would be Betsy, individual would be the business energy tax credit, individual would be the residential energy tax credit, and so that's an important distinction to make. Also, last session, the residential energy tax credit did get a sunset, I believe, of 10 years. We understand that the business energy tax credit will as well. I don't know if John had a response from the industry.
I guess I have a couple of comments to add.
Quickly, because we have a whole group of people sitting behind you.
First of all, I don't know that it's technically that it's double dipping. I think that the manufacturing incentives are primarily geared toward building the facility, not necessarily per panel. So it is different in the Betsy and the Retsy. So it's basically to build the industry in Oregon. And although we are becoming leaders in the solar industry in the United States, we are truly becoming a powerhouse in the Northwest. Washington is a powerhouse. They've been it for a while. They have about four or five manufacturers in there. We want to get at least two or three more into the state of Oregon. So. One other thing about these credits. Most of those manufacturers, and PV Power is a good example in Bend, Oregon right now, over 95% of their product is going out of state. So it's going out and bringing dollars back in, and that's what that's exactly what's going to happen with Solar World and other solar manufacturers. The vast majority of their products is going to be exported out of the state, bringing dollars back in.
And just to clarify, the residential tax credit obviously can only be used by people who pay income tax in Oregon. So if they're exporting at 95, then only 5% can actually realize that residential energy tax credit. So one last comment?
I just follow on this, Madam Chair. And I applaud, you know, what's going on, what we're doing here, and I'm going to be supportive, I think, of this legislation. That isn't the purpose. The purpose of my conversation is simply the recognition, and it is, it may not be as you, and maybe double dipping is kind of the wrong word, but it we get two hits on the revenue department, the revenue stream in the state of Oregon. And, colleagues, that's something that I'm concerned about, because there are a lot of things that, we've got, that are very important for us to fund out there. And the only way I can be at all comfortable with things like tax credits is where I can look at the possibility that this is going to have a long-range positive effect on the, if you wish, the revenue stream in the state of Oregon. And so that's a reason for my questions and for wanting a little more understanding of where you're at there. And thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I really appreciate your comments. And just a reminder, we are the policy committee. We're looking at whether or not this is a good policy. The revenue committee would make a decision about whether there is the revenue to fund this. I do share the concerns with my colleague from Pendleton. You don't have outhouses anymore. Now you flush toilets in Pendleton. I think you're coming into the modern world.
I didn't know that we'd gotten to that advanced technology of having outhouses.
I share your concern, given that I currently have a bill and revenue committee that would sunset all tax credits and require that every program have to come back. And just like we review all of our budgets every 2 years, we would have a rolling review of all of our tax credits, because I do believe we have many on the books that may have outlived their usefulness, and we need to reevaluate those policies. So,
and I applaud the chair for introducing such legislation.
Well, thank you. So I do appreciate your concern, and I think that this there will be a robust discussion in revenue since we have a member
but
of revenue.
Madam Chair, I hate to throw this wrench in the works. I'm just coming from the revenue committee where we introduced a bill today to sunset all sunsets, so I'm not sure how that
Okay, I think it's time to end this panel, and we'll bring up the next one. Thank you, Representative. I appreciate it. Okay. Actually, we have a representative from Representative Bruce Hanna's office who would like to come up. Is there anybody from Representative Witt's office that would like to come up? Okay. And then actually, just to move things along, I'm going to have Jeremiah Bauman up as well, who is a member of the work group. And I'm going to ask folks to keep their, now that we have that long discussion, keep their remarks short, because we have two other hearings and a work session after this, and we want to make sure and have everybody, let everybody who came for this hearing to have a chance to share their comments with us. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Avery. I'm the legislative coordinator for Bruce Hanna, representative from District 7, and he regrets not being able to attend. He's currently out of the state. And I did chop most of my remarks out after hearing, because they've already been covered. Representative Hanna did want to emphasize he believes it's good public policy to incentivize the kinds of growth that we would like to have in the state, and this is certainly one of those. When he first was approached to be part of this teamwork bill, he said, how can we go wrong with a tax incentive for clean energy that's going to expand an emerging industry and will create jobs here in Oregon? And that's what it's all about. So I'm going to stop at that and just say let's give those tax incentives and help let the free market continue to expand, and we'd ask you to move House Bill 3488.
Thank you very much.
Recommendation. Thank you.
Appreciate you being here today and appreciate your testimony. And and here's Representative Witt. Waiting for you at the podium here. And my colleague, Representative Witt, is also a co-sponsor of the bill. Thank you for coming out of committee to join us.
Thank you. This bill file I'm on. Good morning, Madam. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
You just pull your microphone. There you go.
Thank you.
And now we got you in stereo.
Brad Witt, State Representative, House District 31, appearing in behalf of House Bill 2876 this afternoon.
Wait. No, we're in 3488. This is the one that you are co-sponsor for the Business Energy Tax Credit. And you have two bills up in my committee today. You could
yes,
just
I
say
do.
good bill should pass. It's fine.
Good bill should pass.
And we'll be glad to return when we're at 2876.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being co-sponsor on this.
Thank
I know you support this bill. Representative Bauman, you get cleanup, or Jeremiah Bauman, you get cleanup.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. I know you'll be brief.
I will be very brief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with OSPIRG. I will skip over my usual remarks about the virtues of renewable energy and solar energy in particular, and just address a couple of the issues that have come up. On the question of leadership, while it's true Oregon and Washington are leaders in this particular industry, it's also true that the place that our country is at, unfortunately, is the place that renewable energy has had, you know, a little bit of support in the late 70s and early 80s, and then not a whole lot. And then now in the last couple of years, a resurgence of interest and help in terms of building that industry. So unfortunately, leadership relative to the rest of the world doesn't mean a whole lot in this case, and we still have a very emerging industry, despite one that has a very well-developed technology with great consumer benefits, very reliable. And so leadership is good, but we need to be moving even faster. I should also note that leadership is being challenged on almost a monthly basis at this point. Last fall, California, their legislature decided to invest $300 billion in solar energy incentives over the next 10 years. $300 million over the next 10 years. So per capita, that would be the equivalent of Oregon doing about $30 million. A year. So let me just clarify, because I just sort of put a bunch of numbers out, and I'm managing to confuse myself here. The total investment by California is $3 billion over 10 years, so it's $300 million a year. And that is why the per capita equivalent is very roughly, if it's $300 million in California, about $30 million a year for Oregon, given the size of our state. This bill would have us nowhere near that level of investment, but it's still an important step in that direction. But there is something of an arms race going on here, and I think it's important that states that are currently at the front of the pack continue to stay at the front of the pack. Particularly because we've got such high potential for this industry, and it is really a homegrown industry in terms of dozens of small, locally owned companies all over the state that provide and service these systems. And now we've got manufacturers moving into the state as well. There's a huge potential to be a national and world leader as this industry really starts to skyrocket, and I think that's important for the reasons Representative Bruhn outlined. The last thing that I would note, because I think it is a hard question for a policymaker to look at these tax credits and decide how many tax credits to whom and when and where. And there's a lot of questions on the renewable energy field of why they keep getting these tax credits. How long will that have to happen? The one point that I would urge is for the community to take a step back and look at our energy system overall, which in general the energy system is a heavily subsidized, heavily regulated industry. And particularly fossil fuels have enjoyed a century of very heavy subsidization in the form of reduced royalties for oil drilling. The Energy Policy Act of 2005, the Federal Energy Policy Act, actually included new subsidies for oil and gas exploration. And this is not exactly an emerging industry. It's a very mature industry. So that's the context that we're operating in. At the federal scale, the renewable energy credits are absolutely dwarfed by the fossil fuel credits and other tax subsidies. And so I think we do have an important role to play here in encouraging those industries that we think are beneficial to the state.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Jeremiah before we bring up the next panel? Thank you. Okay, I'm going to call three folks up if you come up together so we can work through the list here. Andrew with Solar Energy Solutions, Brent Gunderson with General Contract Incorporated?
GenCon,
okay, and Alan Hickenbottom from Grow Solar. And if you could make sure and state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brent Gunderson, president of GenCon, based in Portland. Sunlight travels from the sun to the earth in 8.5 minutes. I'll be half than that, or less. Such as the bottle bill, the beach bill, and the urban growth boundary bills from the 1970s, House Bill 3488 can be on that same level. So when you retire from the legislature, look back at what you've done today and this session for renewables, and be proud. A couple of quick things for my company is I have over 100 vendors located in Oregon alone that I purchase from. So as a business person, I'm buying all types of business services from the money I get from selling my product in this state and beyond. I sell in Washington and Idaho as well. I'm buying all kinds of materials. I'm buying metals and services and so on. So there's a lot of trickle down from my efforts as a business person. Weekly, I'm asked for a job applications from people calling me from out of state and in state looking for work in this industry. Basically, I've turned them down so far because I'm looking for a long-term vision, not the on and off accelerator switch that government has done in the past. And as a business owner, I need to put my capital where it's going to make a return, and I'll hire those employees to fill that as I see a long-term vision from government in its policies. Let's see. This is a great industry. I've been doing it all my life, and I hope you'll support it, and I thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Koinaskatsi, and I'm the owner and president of Solar Energy Solutions in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to ask your support, SB 3488. And I'm only speaking for myself today, but I also speak as one who's been installing solar systems since 1987, and I'm also the first in the state to become a journeyman as a solar thermal contractor. Since 1987, I've been part of the Sisyphean push of this monstrous rock called solar energy. And I come before you with a lot of experience and perspective on solar energy. City, county, city governments are doing much to move solar energy in the forefront today. However, solar in Oregon is on the edge of ledge of going mainstream. And I could theorize with you about why this is, but that would take a lot more time. What I do feel strongly about is that if solar is going to move beyond that edge, beyond a cottage industry, in an industry as big as any other, where hundreds and hundreds of companies with thousands of workers are installing solar hot water heating systems and photovoltaic systems on every viable residential commercial roof in this great state of Oregon, the state government needs to give us a little bigger push to get all jump started. So I sit here before you asking you to give Oregon the solar push it needs, support 3488. It will help in creating jobs, creating a sustainable industry, help keep the quality of our water, air, and life we all value so highly in this place we call Pacific Paradise. Oregon is on the precipice of solar greatness. Just we need a little push. Please support 3488. Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to say you can work for the tourism board when you're done with solar. I think we certainly could use your help.
Happily.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Alan Hickenbottom. I'm with Grow Solar. Specifically, I'd like to address the section of 3488, which deals with the changes in the yearly allocation for the Betsy. I'm responsible for medium to large size PV systems sales to customers here in the state. From a capital standpoint, these systems can be anywhere from $200,000 to $1 million, and with utility scale, can be several million dollars. These are certainly significant investments. In my experience with my customers, I spend little time talking about the why, which is good, actually. It's internalized now. About 20% talking about the technology and 80% of my time talking about money. These are businesses, and financial decisions tend to drive this. So the changes that are in 3488 will add a little additional push and actually make it compatible with, or not compatible, but like current legislation that is the 10% the first year, 10% the second, and the 5% the following. Currently in Senate Bill 20, or House Bill 2211, it's flat at 10, 10, 10, 10, 10. The changes in 3488, as you probably know, make that 15, 15, 10, 5, 5. And so then it looks like current legislation as far as how those tax credits are used by a person that does not use the pass-through option. Anything we can do to increase the financial attractiveness to the corporate CFOs who tend to make these decisions is going to help. So in closing, I'd like to thank and really congratulate, maybe to echo some of Brent's comments, thank and congratulate the committee on their efforts to improve the environment, no pun intended, for renewables in Oregon. And for someone who does observe what's going on in other states, to put it in perspective, hopefully with the renewable energy standard, with the 50% Betsy that we have and the improved net metering laws coming, you can be assured that Oregon will be among the leaders in the progressive states in the renewables. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here, gentlemen. Appreciate your input. Are there any questions for the panel?
Madam Chair,
if we could just for a moment help
us understand, and I guess I'm directing this particularly towards Brent and Andrew, since they spoke, I think, primarily to the residential energy tax credit. I assume that's what you guys are working with your customers and primarily. What this will mean, what these changes will mean in terms of the kind of calculation that a potential residential customer would undergo. I mean, how does this change their decision? Are we talking about reducing costs by an order of magnitude of 50% or something much smaller than that? It's hard to tell without having, you know, spent a lot of time looking at these calculations. It's hard to tell from the tax credit what this actually means for the consumer.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, what I'm seeing out in the marketplace is a lot of the low-hanging fruit has been tapped, and we're going after a much harder customer now. They may not make as much income. They need, meaning they don't have enough as much disposable income. So they're looking for every avenue they can before they make a decision in this venue. So an increased incentive at the residential is going to assist. Also, the credit at the residential level is much lower because the federal cap of $2,000. Whereas in the business side, there is no cap. So we're hitting the ceiling already that we're seeing. And so you couple that with, the customers are a little harder to get. And to transform them into a buyer, this is an incentive that will help us do that.
I would just like to add that I think that with this incentive, more people come on board installing these systems. So it'll go more mainstream. More plumbing contractors, more electrical contractors will jump on board, seeing that the state government is also on board.
I guess if I could just follow up, and maybe later witnesses can address this question. I was looking just this week at what it would cost to install solar hot water in a home. And I, went online, went to City of Portland, saw the estimates and the, I think, roughly $4,000, $4,500 that it would cost out of my pocket after I took advantage of the current tax credits. I'm wondering what this change does to that bottom line. I mean, that's a fairly long payback period still. For that initial upfront investment. So how much does this change that bottom line for, say, a typical solar hot water installation? We could then talk about PV and electricity generation. But
well, it's huge. It's huge. I don't know how to quantify that. I see that, with the increase of the tax credit, that much more people are going to be their appetite will be whetted in a much better way.
Thanks.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. We have James Reismiller and Cliff Schrock, please. And for the, can you make sure and state your name for the record, please?
Sure. My name is James Reese Miller. Thank you for having me, Representative Dingfelder and members of the committee. I'm a small business owner. I got in this business about a year and a half ago. I'm from Corvallis. And in the last year, I've installed about 20 systems, residential size. I'm a one-man shop, looking at hiring my first employee into this business. And what I'm seeing out in the field right now is everybody wants a 2-kilowatt system. I install PV systems, and the reason they want this size system is because that's the cap on the residential energy tax credit at this point. So at this point, what a person can buy is a 2-kilowatt system, which is 2,000 watts DC rated, and they're going to get $3 per watt tax credit. So they're going to get a total tax credit of $6,000. What this new bill is going to allow them to do, instead of buying that 2-kilowatt system, they're going to buy up to a 5-kilowatt system, which is much closer to what the average residential house needs to meet all of their needs. See, what's happening now is most people are saying, well, I want this 2-kilowatt system. How much of my electricity is that going to cover on my house? And I'm going to tell them that's going to cover 20 to 30%. And they say, well, why would I want to invest in this if it's, if it's only going to cover 20 to 30% of my electricity. And my explanation for that is, you know, it's basically that's the sweet spot because that's where the tax credits are at, and that's where people want to buy into it. And so, what you were asking before about the breakdown of the cost, the net cost is going to be similar after this. But it's going to grow proportionally, you know, depending on the size system. So right now, a person's system, average cost of a 2-kilowatt system, this is the sweet spot, is around $18,000 up front. And then with tax credits and incentives, that comes down to about $10,000. Right now, if somebody wants to buy a 3-kilowatt system, their upfront cost is about $9 a watt. So do the math for me. Nine times three, 28 is going to be, they're going to get 8,000. So they're going to pay double the cost, the net cost for a 3-kilowatt system of what they would pay for a 2-kilowatt system. That's because of the way the tax credits are structured right now, and that's the residential PV tax credit. And it's a similar situation with the hot water as well. That $4,500 net cost you were talking about is going to be decreased to about $3,000 from the way I understand it. Don't quote me on that. I'm an electrician. I don't do solar hot water at this point. But from my standpoint, this is going to allow me to hire another employee. This is going to allow me to buy more solar products and install them on homes and get more clean energy for people here in the state. And I just wanted to end this by saying that my inspiration for doing this was actually hearing a speech by Al Gore in high school. Before anybody was talking about global climate change, this guy was talking about the environment and what the economy is going to look like when I'm an adult. And he was saying, you're the generation that's going to come up with the solutions to the problems that we're creating right now. And I feel like I'm part of that solution. And my name is James Reese Miller, Abundant Solar. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name's Cliff Schrock. I'm the renewable manager for Inland Electric. I was here on Monday, too, in case you're wondering. We're an IBEW contractor, and we've installed dozens of solar systems in the Portland, Oregon area in the last 4 years. But I've personally been involved with high tech for 34 years, and other contractors today have told you about what it'll do on the contracting end of the business to have a bill like this passed. What I did was I just borrowed from Solar World and ODE this little science fair display to very quickly talk about the magnitude of the opportunity we're dealing with here. My math, I'd be glad to defend it. We could, there's $6 billion of solar panel manufacturing that's going to be floating somewhere around California, Oregon, Arizona in the next 6 years. Solar World is one big piece of it. There's another company that's talking about making the raw spherical silicon. And within, if we get both those in the state, we'll be producing more power per year in PV, 300 megawatts, than the largest wind farms we have in the state already, which are 250 megawatt. These are all the pieces you make solar panels, the silicon, the growing of the wafers, the slicing of the wafers, the preparing of the wafers, and finally putting the wafers in the little panels you have on the roof that actually make the power. This is a huge opportunity for the state. It's a huge opportunity for our employment, and with your support on solar bills like HB 3488, and in fact all the bills this session, I think Oregon could be in 10 years what it is today in microelectronics. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this committee before we get the Department of Energy up? All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Bill Nesmith with the Department of Energy. Go ahead when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Nesmith. I'm Assistant Director for Conservation at the Oregon Department of Energy. The department is neutral on this bill because of revenue impacts that are not foreseen in the governor's budget. We believe the bill has merit and contains important initiatives, and we would be very happy to support the content of the bill if the legislature chooses to move forward, and we look forward to that opportunity. I'd also be happy to answer any questions that you might have about any aspect here.
Okay. Representative Cannon has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this gets to the RETC and a little bit of the question I was asking earlier. Do you have the bill in front of you? I'm looking on page 6, lines 33 to 35.
Chair, answer the interruption. Okay, yes.
Okay. Could you explain to me how this works? We're adding a new sort of level of credit available, I assume, to residential customers, but I guess I'm having trouble understanding what it means to provide a $3,000 for the first year energy yield in kilowatt hours per year multiplied by 120 cents per dwelling. And I need some help working through that.
I'll do my best. I'm actually not probably the best resource on this, but if I may, I'll link that section in to the next page as well.
Mm-hmm.
There is an increase in the cap from 2,000 watts to 5,000 watts, which also results in an increase from 1,500 to 3,750. They're all tied together. And the net effect is we're essentially doubling the incentive that's available for domestic water heating.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yeah, and I think that Mr. Miller, did you have a clarification?
I might have some answers.
Which of these, I mean, if I was a customer trying to figure out what the, a potential customer trying to figure out what the impact of this bill would be on my bottom line as I look at potentially installing a solar system, I wonder which of these should I pay attention to? Am I very likely to take the cap, which I understand we'd be proposing to raise to $3,750 on virtually any type of installation? If not, then I need to get back into this 3,000 times 120 cents per dwelling and energy yield in kilowatt hours. I just can't see my way clearly through what this means for customers.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Miller, for the record again. They're separate issues. So the $3,750 is specifically for the PV systems. The $3,000 is for the solar hot water systems, and the $1.20 or the 120 cents is specifically to calculate the incentive for the solar hot water systems. So you'd ask the question about what that changes to someone buying solar hot water systems. These systems can cost between about $7,500 to as much as $11,000 for a solar hot water system. So $3,000 would come off of that approximately $8,000 or $9,000 for the system with the other incentives. And we would have I think it's in there, but if it's not, we would definitely be open to it. And it's the same way that the PV incentives is limited to 50% of the overall system costs. It cannot go above that. The same thing would be true or should be true of the solar hot water credit as well.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair. And that 120 cents per is there a multiplier going on here? 3,000 times 120, is it actually 3,600?
The multiplier is 120 cents times kilowatt hours. The cap is 3,000. It cannot go higher than 3,000. So the multiplier is the 120 cents, and it's time the annual kilowatt hours that solar hot water system produces.
Thanks. That helps.
And just to follow up on that, do we have any sense what the average home, you know, if you have, I don't know, what's the average hot water, about 40 gallons, and what is that, what would an average homeowner expect that they would be receiving for an incentive?
For an incentive today, the state tax credit are probably doing pretty well from around 1,300 to 1,500, and so we expect the same thing to be true with this change to 3,000. It will increase from somewhere to around, some of them won't make the 3,000, so it will be somewhere between 25 to 2,700 to 3,000.
Madam Chair, if I might, I think I see part of the source of my confusion is a misprint in the bill. As I read it, it should say $3,000 or the first year energy yield in kilowatt hours per year multiplied by 120 cents per dwelling. I think that's a mistake in the drafting of the bill. That's certainly consistent, that or rather than for, right. Is consistent right. With what our witness is saying and is consistent with the earlier subsections of this.
Well, yeah, I think what they did was followed, if you look down below, I think they must have followed the language for tax years, and they just put it for, I don't know. That, yeah,
that could be true. That it's meant as a calculation to get at the 3,000, that 120 cents.
Okay, and it's mm-hmm. either the energy yield in kilowatt hours times 120 cents per kilowatt hour or 3,000, the lesser of the two, and I think that's what you get back on line 20. Okay, I
right.
I understand
it's,
this.
It's correct on page 7, line 4.
Okay.
Okay. That's clarifying.
That helps.
Yep. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative McPherson.
Well, I just want to follow on that line of questioning because I'm trying to understand this as well, and I found these numbers pretty dense and confusing.
That's why we're not the Revenue Committee.
Well, although it's getting late enough in the process, probably the more eyes that look at these things, the better. I mean, invite a comment on one of the mathematical relationships. We're in one place in the residential credit doubling the numbers from $1,500 to $3,000. Or from 60 cents to 120 cents, but then when we get down to the solar electric system, we're going 2.5 times from 2,000 to 5,000 watts, $1,500 to $3,750. Now, I don't really understand all the mathematics of what's going on, but is there a policy reason why in one place it's being doubled and elsewhere it's being increased by more than that, 2.5 times?
They're definitely different, so they're not there isn't a linear relationship, but between the solar hot water and the solar electric. If you tried to save the same amount of kilowatt hours with solar electric, the system would be far more expensive, quite frankly. So there is no relationship between the 2x for the solar hot water and the other 2.5x or whatever it is for the solar electric. So we didn't try to. I'm sure there wasn't any intent there to try to match them. The other thing is that this is the first year that we've increased the solar hot water. The solar electric has been increased in the past. So it's like it's catching up to some of the other ones. 2212 right now addresses that, and this was one of my points. 2212 addresses that for wind and for the fuel cells, but it forgot solar hot water. So that's one of the pieces of this. Don't forget solar hot water, please.
A follow-up, if I could. If I'm understanding, the policy choice is that there are some technologies, and solar electric being one of those, where the paybacks are more challenging, and so there's a larger tax subsidy being given mm-hmm. under this proposal.
Yes. The solar hot water systems cost between $7,500, probably even $8,000 to $11,000. A solar electric system will cost you between $14,000 to $35,000 or more.
Okay. And the payback period, that really affects the payback period.
It can.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I mean, the tax credit can help. It really helps accelerate the payback period, basically, and make it more economical, as we've looked at both for our little humble abode. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Anybody else that would like to testify in House Bill 3488? Gentlemen in the back. If you can please state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
My name is Douglas Van Zandt, and I represent Stapleton Electric and Solar in Portland, Oregon. We're a growing solar electric business. And I'd like to thank you very much for your time, and I'd also like to ask you to support 3488. These are tools to help us as small business, but they're also tools that benefit all Oregonians.
Can I just ask you to slide the mic towards you? There you go.
These are tools that can help us grow our businesses. These are tools that can help us grow this business sector. These are tools that enable us to create jobs
here in Oregon, and it also helps us to keep money here in Oregon in a number of ways. First of all, is the through the business energy tax credit and the renewable energy tax credit. Those are tools that are putting solar systems on Oregon houses by Oregon businesses, again, keeping the money here in Oregon. But it also keeps us from shipping money that we would spend on energy that might be produced out of state and keeping it here in Oregon. And speaking of money, there's two real controlling factors that we see in our business that affect how and why we can put it, or if we can put a system on a house or a business or a property here in Oregon. And it's solar access or the amount of solar light that hits the area, or are there any shading issues. And the second thing is budget. And these are tools that really help with that. By increasing the business energy tax credit from 35% to 50% is a really key, important aspect of that. And also by front-loading it, having it be 15% in the first couple of years and then 10 and 5% in the ensuing years really help make the numbers work. And this is about making a big capital expenditure for businesses and also for residents. And on the residential end, right now, the residential energy tax credit sort of caps out at about 2,000-watt system, and this will enable clients who we're seeing would like to put larger systems on their house by raising it up to putting a 5,000-watt system on. In summary, I'd really like you to support 3488. It benefits Oregons. It creates jobs. It enables us to grow our business. It keeps money here in Oregon. It enables us to take a proactive approach to solving this challenge. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming here today. Any questions before we release Mr. Van Zandt? Thank you. And with that, if there's anyone else that would like to testify on this bill, okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3488. And I'm actually going to open up a hearing on House Bill 2018 first, and then if we have time, we will hear the last bill. All right, thanks for coming. Why don't I have 2018? Do I not have 2018?
You want mine?
Yeah. What happened? Yeah, my staff is okay. She has one. Okay. So we have a public hearing on 2018, and I have Alex Kyler and... Is Terry?
Glenn Potter.
Glenn Potter. Okay. We also have the Eugene Chamber of Commerce. So, do you all want to come up? Is Terry here? This is Eugene. This is Eugene Day here. And you can go out and let him know. We'll start the hearing when we have time. If you can do that. Kat, can you give us an overview of the bill?
House Bill 2018 increases the limit on fees imposed by local government for implementing local community right to know regulatory programs.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here today. Alex, why don't you go ahead and start?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm the City of Eugene's legislative analyst, and I'm here to speak in support of HB 2018. To my knowledge, Eugene has the only right-to-know regulatory program in the state of Oregon. Our program addresses the use of toxic chemicals by manufacturers located in Eugene and requires that businesses with more than 10 employees pay a fee to the city and that the chemicals they utilize in their manufacturing businesses are reported to the city. The city then makes that information public through a posting on our website and by filing the reports at the Eugene Public Library. The law was initiated and passed by Oregon by Eugene voters in 1996 as a charter amendment. Importantly, City Council cannot violate the charter by ordinance or resolution. The charter is quite detailed in terms of laying out what the program looks like and what it does. There's an oversight board, public notification requirements, establishment of fees and forms, and enforcement guidance. The program costs the city approximately $100,000 per year to administer, and I've given you just a sheet out of our budget document that kind of shows where the costs have been for the last several years. It's a pretty stable program in terms of expenses. These costs have been fairly stable, and there's no plan to expand the program, and in fact, little ability to expand the scope of the program due to its embeddedness in the city charter. Certain trade associations saw this program as perhaps being duplicated around the state of Oregon and took steps in the 1999 legislative session to enact preemptive language. They were successful in instilling a per-facility fee cap of $2,000 for local right-to-know regulatory programs. What this meant was that smaller businesses would pay proportionately higher fees than larger companies. As a result of that action, fees in Eugene climbed from just over $10 per FTE, full-time equivalent, to over $30 per FTE, and to my knowledge, no other communities have adopted a toxics right-to-know program. If passed, House Bill 2018 will reduce the current fee in Eugene of $37 per FTE down to $17 per FTE. Most businesses will enjoy a halving of their fees, although obviously some businesses will experience an increase, some of those larger businesses. Committee members, those trade associations that enacted the preemption are not here today voicing opposition to this bill. It is still rather unlikely that a community in Oregon will pursue such a program, but our citizens wanted transparency, and they have it. And what this bill does is bring some equity and progressiveness back into the fee structure that we charge. So with that, I'm going to turn the remainder of our testimony over to Glenn Potter. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Potter. Thank you for hearing our testimony today. I am the manager of the City of Eugene Toxics Right to Know program. I've been in that position for 10 years now, so for almost the entire life of our program. Mr. Kyler gave you a fairly thorough history of the program and the nature of our fee structure. I wanted to refer you to the chart that we've submitted along with our other written materials to explain the effects of House Bill 2018. At this time, there's a $2,000 cap per facility on fees. Before that cap was imposed, it was imposed by 1999 legislation, but it didn't take effect until 2004. So up until 2004, we were able to charge a flat rate per FTE, which was between $10 and $15 an FTE for all 73 companies participating in the program. Then the $2,000 cap took effect. Well, with revenues remaining stable at approximately $100,000, it's just a math question. The smaller companies had to take up the slack because the larger companies were then not paying any more than $2,000. So the fees for the smaller companies went up from about $13 to $30 or so in 2004 and have stayed there. This bill would remedy that. Based on our calculations and assuming a stable revenue requirement, the fee for a company with fewer than 117 FTE would drop from $37.38 per FTE down to $17, a little bit more than half. And as Alex said, the larger companies would, of course, pay more than the existing $2,000 cap under this legislation. There are 73 companies participating in the program and paying fees. 61 of them would benefit from this legislation financially, and 12 would pay more. City of Eugene is in support. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Terry Connolly. I'm here on behalf of the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce. We have a slightly different perspective on this bill. Our organization is opposed to House Bill 2018. Fundamentally, we don't believe that any business in Eugene should have to pay more than $2,000 annually in fees to support a community right-to-know program. We think it's important if you understand, in addition to the fees, a lot of the conversations about fees, but these businesses also incur costs to comply with the reporting that's required in this type of regulation. We also have some lingering concerns about the current fee structure itself relative to ORS 453-4026. Eugene charges fees to 70 manufacturing companies. I should point out that approximately 30 of those companies are not required to report. The city simply added them to the program to charge them fees to support the program. So we've always been concerned about that and opposed to that. The legislature or the laws require that fees to support a community right to know program, these are done by ordinance, but they are based on a determination of charging fees to the 70 manufacturers assuming that they use any quantity of hazardous substance above zero. Some would maintain that that threshold makes these a quantity-based fee, and if they are a quantity-based fee, then they do have to comply, or we need the legislature needs to make sure that they are consistent with state law in regard to they are not being used to, they're being used solely to supplement the fire marshal program and not duplicate that. But aside from that, we think it's important for you to know that you're having this hearing today, and yet the past 2 years, when these fees have come before the Eugene City Council, they're required to hold the hearing each year to set the fees for each year's budget. In 2006 and 2007, only four people testified at those hearings. None of their comments were even germane to the fees. And none of the comments were submitted by manufacturing companies. So what does that mean? Well, whether you like this program or dislike this program, sometimes keeping things status quo isn't a bad alternative. Most close observers would probably tell you that the past two reporting years have been the least political and most routine in the history of this program. That's why we think it would be unfortunate for the legislature to intervene and disrupt things now when the fees or perceived inequities in fees aren't even a significant issue in Eugene. And if Eugene is truly concerned about the perceived inequities, then they have other remedies at their disposal to address this that don't require a legislative fix. For example, we're convinced this program could reduce its budget a little and not interfere with the output that's needed or the administration of the program. That would be one way to reduce fees. And again, we simply do not think that any company in Eugene or elsewhere should be required to have to pay over $2,000 a year in fees. We also are concerned. There have been previous attempts to expand this program in Eugene. There's always the potential that may arise in the future by some form, and therefore we believe the cap at $2,000 provides an important safeguard to Eugene businesses should someday this program get expanded to other categories other than just manufacturing companies. And as stated, there have been previous attempts, as was stated in the comments. Right now there's not. But there's always that potential. There's always potential for future charter amendments, and we think the fee cap provides an important safeguard to Eugene businesses. So that states our concerns about this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
And I see that one of the bill sponsors is now in the room, Representative Barnhart. So I'm going to ask Representative Barnhart to come up because I think he wanted to make some comments. I apologize. We moved a little faster than we thought. And you can stay there, gentlemen, if you want. We'll have a representative come up because there may be some questions. Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, and a part of that district is within the city of Eugene, and so I'm familiar with this issue. The issue has come before the legislature a number of times in the past. The purpose of this bill, as I understand it, is simply to raise the maximum amount that may be charged for a single facility in any calendar year from $2,000 to $10,000. Now, that may look initially as though we're talking about some kind of an increase in the operation of this sector, but that isn't what this bill is about. The bill is about the distribution of the costs among businesses in the city of Eugene for the operation of this program. With the $2,000 limit currently in place, that means that fees on smaller businesses must be substantially higher in order to pay the cost of the operation. And the fees on larger businesses are limited to the $2,000 limit. I have to tell you, I don't know the details of the legislative history of this law, except that I believe that there was an attempt some years ago to prevent the city of Eugene from collecting a fee, and that the ultimate resolution of that was to establish the $2,000 limit. I don't believe that's good policy. I think better policy would be to allow the city to establish its own fees based on the issues that it would like to use, and hence the bringing of this bill by those of us, several of us who include portions of the city of Eugene in our districts.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll take some questions now. Representative Cannon.
Madam Chair, Thank you. I wonder if any thought, and I guess I put this to you, Representative Bernhardt, I wonder if you gave any thought to abolishing this section of Oregon statute altogether. This is a local program. It was adopted through local charter. I wonder why it's necessary to regulate it through the state, put sort of walls around it.
Representative Cannon, in writing this bill, we were attempting to make the minimum changes we thought were useful for the project or for the program. I would certainly have no objection to returning local control to the local government on this kind of issue. The relating clause on this bill would allow the legislature to do that, I believe.
Okay. Representative Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll get to that one. My first question would be the $10,000 and the reasoning behind that $10,000 fee. And I don't know if you can answer that.
I can't answer that, but I think the city probably can.
Somebody want to try it?
Madam Chair, Representative Byer, I'll take a shot at that. I guess $10,000 is perhaps just seen as more palatable by opponents of this legislation than a simple repeal of the cap. The city of Eugene would be in favor of a full repeal.
Well, and thank you for that. I will say when I opened the bill up and saw the $10,000 fee, I thought it was a pretty hefty increase over the $2,000 cap. And it would appear to me that even if we did raise this cap to $10,000, we know that you've been able to adjust fees inside there significantly to make up the amount, and I'm not sure that there's anything there that would stop you from actually raising more money by adjusting those fees at this point, as long as no one person group is paying over the $10,000.
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Byer, thank you for that question. That argument has been advanced. Two responses. A, we do not now use the full billing capacity that we have. We operate this program at the minimum necessary. And so the cap that is in place now at $2,000 does not even affect a great many of the businesses now in the program. There are solid bipartisan political forces at work here in favor of keeping the expenses of this program down to the minimum. The business community for obvious reasons, the environmental community because they don't want the program criticized for being expensive. I have every reason to believe that our expenditures will stay at or near $100,000 per year and that this is strictly a redistribution bill.
Follow up. And their colleagues is my concern about abolishing this because there is a lot of history behind this particular program in Eugene, and not everybody is in agreement. And I would definitely not be supporting abolishing a cap at this point. And as a matter of fact, I'm not sure I'd be supporting a $10,000 cap either. I would like to think maybe this, if we were to adjust this at all, it might need to be lower for me to vote for it. Okay. Any other questions for this panel? And I see that we're going to bring Mr. Carler back up. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Byer, I just wanted to point out that, indeed, before this cap was imposed, as Mr. Potter was speaking about, and the fees were set at about $10 per full-time employee. At that point in time, even the largest companies in Eugene were, and I don't have the exact numbers, but I believe the highest the fee was charged was about $7,700 under that program. Given the FTE at that particular large manufacturer today, if those fees were still at the $10, that we'd still be capped out, if you will, at $10,000 for that one company. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that if the law were not in place at all, we would still be charging at about the $10,000 cap, hence the $10,000 figure.
Okay, any other questions?
Just a comment that I have a real kind of heartburn with this section of statute, if only because it seems like it was developed to try to strike a delicate political balance in Eugene, but it may have the unintended consequence of making it more difficult or easier, but having a bearing on what other municipalities are able to do when considering their own right to know regulatory programs. So I approach changing this section of law with real trepidation, not only because of what it might mean for Eugene, but what it might mean for other cities. And I hate to think that other municipalities are going to have to sort of put themselves in the box of a political compromise that's worked for Eugene, but may play very differently in other cities. So, I think I would support the increase of this cap, but I'd be even happier not to see this section of law at all.
Representative McPherson.
I wasn't intending to make that comment, but I will echo the last comments that Representative Cannon made. This may be taking the discussion off in not a productive direction, but the FTE basis for the calculation, it strikes me that it has some relationship to the total amount of economic activity of a business, but no relationship to its propensity to generate toxic substances. So just comment a little bit on the use of FTE as the basis.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for your question. We are precluded by ORS 453-4026 from charging on the basis of quantity of chemicals reported. And so as an alternative, we fell back on the FTE basis. It is seen by the Eugene Toxics Board as reflective, at least generally, of ability to pay. We have also done a study that supports some rough correlation between FTE and amount of hazardous substances used. FTE basis is the best we can do.
Okay. Any other comments before we close the public hearing?
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, again, I would remind the committee that approximately 30 of those companies that are paying me in charge FTEs aren't even required to report. They were never intended to be in the program to begin with, so there is no nexus between them being charged and what they may be producing. And so that's been an issue of concern to us all along, too, when the city chose to add additional companies for funding the program when they were never intended in the charter to be part of this program to begin with.
Okay, any other questions for this panel?
I'm just going to offer a comment, Madam Chair, just very briefly. We burden the employment relationship so substantially in many ways in our regulatory system and our economy, and it's one of the reasons why it's hard to get to generate the levels of employment that we have traditionally, and this is just an example of that, so I'm troubled by the structure.
So noted. Would you like to make any other comments before we...
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, that was my understanding in the 99 session, mm-hmm. was that there was some alarm, if you will, that other communities might do this kind of thing, that citizens might discover what the businesses in their communities were using. And so this was a rather elegant, I suppose, for those of us who look at preemptive language sometimes, from time to time, in the local government realm, this was a rather elegant way of creating a preemption. And we've been here on a number of occasions. We fought it then, and this is the second session where we've tried to bring this cap up as well. So a little bit trying to untangle that preemptive language that was established back then.
Thank you for the comments and questions. So, anything else before we close the public hearing? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else that'd like to testify on this bill? We only had 3 people signing up. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2018, and now I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2785. Kat, could you tell us about the bill, and I do believe we have an amendment that we've been waiting for.
House Bill 2785 allows a water right holder to use an expedited application process to apply to the Water Resources Department to appropriate water for hydroelectric purposes under an existing water right if the proposed hydroelectric project qualifies for a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission exemption. We have in front of us, hot off the press, a -4 amendment, and I believe Anita Winkler and
Debbie Colbert are going to walk us through that.
Okay, thank you. Debbie Colbert from the Water Resources Department and Anita Winkler, and I think we have some other people that may want to talk about it. Debbie, can you walk us through the amendment, please?
Actually, you want
to? You both will.
If it's okay with you, Chair, there are amendments, and it's been our bill, so I sort of hate to put that on Debbie at this point.
Okay, and for the record?
For the record, I'm Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We're distributing some testimony, and so the first thing I will say is the testimony was written around the Dash 3 amendments, and you have in front of you the Dash 4, so the first thing you do is substitute Dash 4 for Dash 3. And the second thing you do is ignore the back page. So just as a reminder, this bill was brought to you by the Oregon Water Resources Congress and the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. And Katie Fast makes her apologies. She had a conflict this afternoon, so she would have been here otherwise, but she just couldn't make it today. So I'm speaking on behalf of both organizations. This bill was before you in a hearing before, several groups raised some concerns, and we were asked to sit down with those groups. The amendments before you today are the result of the discussions with the Congress, with the Farm Bureau, Water Watch, Water Resources Department, and Fish and Wildlife Department. And I want to say thank you to everybody. This was a little tough to get to at times, but I think what you have in front of you is a very solid bill. The whole concept behind this...
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Did I miss Water for Life, or did you miss...
They were not part of this discussion. They, as I recall, I'm not sure they even testified on the bill.
They did not.
This bill lets somebody who has a water right for another purpose, and in our district's case it would be primarily for irrigation, add a new use to that through a new certificate, and that a new use of hydropower generation. That means they're already diverting the water for something else, and they're just, as I describe it, dropping hydro into their delivery system. And that's real critical, because we're not changing anything that happens at the point of diversion. We're not changing anything about the water rights diversion when it's being used, anything like that. We're just adding this service. And that's real key to the amendments you have in front of you. I think the easiest way is to just quickly go through these the amendments to let you know what we were trying to do and that we think we've accomplished. First was to make sure that these little hydro systems are only in man-made conveyances. They can't be put in a natural stream. So it's the ditches, the canals, pipes, whatever people are using to move the water. Secondly, that the certificate for hydro does not create a new right in the sense of doesn't create any more water. It's simply an additional use of the water that's already being diverted. And it doesn't create a right to divert any water. Next, it says that the hydropower under the certificate does not have its own priority date, and that goes along with it's not a new right. That means if the department has to regulate water along a stream, they're not going to regulate based on this hydro use. They're only going to regulate based on the underlying water right, whether it's irrigation or municipal, whatever that use is. It ensures that the certificate for hydropower is tied closely to the exemptions from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission where that is applicable. Ensures the fees for the certificate are deposited in the appropriate fund at Water Resources. It's the Hydroelectric Fund. Describes the process for providing public notice and receiving comments and for determining any public interest is raised by the application. Allows the fees for this application, which are a reduced fee, to be applied to the more extensive process if that application can't clear under this streamlined process. So it's $500 if I apply and I can't clear the requirements here and I need to kick over into the full process, that $500 will be credited towards the fee for the full process. Ensures that this certificate doesn't expand the underlying water rights, doesn't change time of use, doesn't change the duty, the rate, anything else. It just allows us, again, to add that service. Requires measurement and reporting of the quantity of water diverted. Requires a view of the hydro water right after 50 years. That's similar to what's required under FERC. Requires the FERC exemption be in place. They have to have that exemption in hand before the department can issue the certificate under this water right. And if for any reason FERC rescinds or cancels that exemption, this water right becomes invalid. Only the certificate part, not the underlying right. So as I said, ignore the stuff on the back page. That was related to the Dash 3 amendments, and those concerns have been incorporated in the Dash 4 amendments that are in front of you today. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Debbie, would you like to add something on behalf of the department?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess I would just say that our department supports these amendments, and also I am speaking in behalf of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and saying that they also are supportive of the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay, and are there any questions for the panel members here?
Madam,
Representative Cannon.
Madam Chair, does this, I guess my question is, does this represent a consensus document on the part of the work group participants? Are they all happy with this, or?
I don't know that you would say happy. They are accepting. Need to say it wasn't a work group. It was just a group of us that got together to work on it.
I'm going to bring up Water Watch here in a minute, who I think worked on these as well, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And this replaces the original bill.
As it says at the top, you add from page 4 on, and the original bill are deleted, and this is all. It was just cleaner to do it this way than try and do the line-by-line amendments.
Okay. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
If we didn't know better, then it would be a gut and stuff.
That would be correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask Doug Meyer. Water Watch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doug Myers, representing Water Watch. I just got the Dash 4s less than a minute ago, so I haven't had a chance to review them at all. But our Kimberly Priestley, who's not in the office today, has been working with Anita Winkler on these, and we have a promise from Anita that if we are not in agreement with this, by the time it hits the floor, we'll make certain agreements in the floor debate. So the legislative intent is clear. And Water Watch does not support, nor do we oppose, the intent of the bill. It's just the language that we're concerned about, again, which we have not had a chance to review.
Okay. But you or Kimberly was there. And, Nita, why don't you come back up, please, as part of the discussions. And did she get a chance to review the proposed language?
This bill, as you can tell from the numbers, had 4 amendments. Each time one has come out, there have had to be some changes, and each time we sent it out to everybody that's been involved. The Dash 4s that are in front of you differ from the Dash 3s only in 2 small instances, and if you really want to see it, they're on the back of my testimony. And they were things that were omitted from the changes we'd asked for, and part of it was our error, and part of it was just something that got dropped out. So My message to Kimberly when I emailed her this morning about what was going on was that there were 2 things that were left out of the version she had seen before, and it's those 2 pieces that are added in by the Dash 4. So while I can't speak for Kimberly, I'm very confident that there's nothing in here that is different than what she had seen before.
Madam Chair, as you know, this happens at the end of the session. So.
Okay, thank you. Any questions about... I know it's been a couple weeks since we had the original hearing on this, but if you recall, there was quite a bit of discussion on the original bill, and also the governor came in and talked, the governor's office came in and said this aligns with the governor's renewable action plan. I think there was quite a bit of discussion about that, and you'll see in your bill folders you should have quite a bit of testimony. Any other questions for either of the panelists?
Madam Chair, is it the end of the session?
Close.
I was being very, very hopeful.
It is close, as we are here nearing the end of hearing House bills. Okay, thank you for your work on this. Appreciate
thank you, Madam
it.
Chair, members.
Okay, with that, I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2785.
Okay, Representative Cannon moves the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2785. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. The Dash 4 amendments are adopted.
And Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2785 as amended by the Dash 4s to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee be rescinded. Because that's what I was told to say.
Yes, we have a letter from the Speaker's office requesting that the Ways and Means referral be removed.
Right.
Or rescinded, I should say. Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2785 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee be rescinded. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Smith, excused. Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Benson?
Aye.
Representative Burley, excused. Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 2785, as amended with the dash fours, has been adopted. Or passed, I should say. And Representative Jensen, would you like to carry this? Or?
I will.
Okay, thank you. Representative Jensen, I don't think Representative Jensen's had a chance to carry a bill yet from the committee. Oh, you did have the Hanford bill.
Yes,
thank you. So Representative Jensen will carry the bill, and I know he'll do a great job. Thank you. With that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2785, and since we're out of time, we will have to hold over the hearing and repost the hearing for House Bill 2876. And with that, I'm going to close the House Energy and Environment Committee.